Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
When trained researchers apply their talents to studying the afterlife evidence, they discover that human life really is eternal. And they discover something that I think is much more important. They begin to discover God. Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes. Our guest today is PMH Atwater, who is a wonderful, wonderful human being. You're going to enjoy this so much. Dr. Atwater has been for nearly 40 years the foremost researcher in the field of near-death experiences. And I call her this for a number of reasons. First, she was one of the first to even study near-death experiences. If you recall your history, the term didn't even exist before the mid-70s. Dr. Raymond Moody coined it in his wonderful, groundbreaking book, Life After Life. And then, that was 75, I believe, in 1977, Dr. Atwater had she never does anything halfway. She had two really big near-death experiences. And unlike many people who sort of make it more about themselves or maybe go on and just live their lives, she devoted her life to studying what that was. And I can identify with that because I had, in childhood, two experiences of light. And I devoted my life to trying to understand what that had been. So as a result, when she and I talked, there's this wonderful resonance because she came at studying the afterlife evidence by looking at near-death experiences. And in a near-death experience, even though the body for time may not be able to sustain life, and eventually people return to their bodies. I study only, although I have looked at near-death experiences, I've been studying people's completed deaths and what they have to tell us. So we're looking at the same set of phenomena from two different sets of information. And one of the glorious things about that is that we've come to so many of the same conclusions, but we don't always agree, and that kind of makes it fun. Welcome, PMH. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, I'm glad to be here, but please know that I died three times in 3 months in 1977.
Well, I thought it was two. You had three.
And then later that year, I had three major relapses. So... You know, most people seem to forget that near-death experiences come from violence or trauma. So you have a body to rebuild afterward. And I was one of those people that had to relearn how to stand, how to walk, how to crawl, how to run, how to tell the difference between left and right, how to see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all my belief systems. So it took me a full year before I was even reasonably a human being again.
How old were you when this happened?
Oh, gee. I don't know. I'm in late 30s.
Okay. Because you already had family, right?
And
you had three children.
Mid
life. Yeah. And this must have been really very upsetting then to your family that suddenly you were in
that condition. Tore everything apart.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well,
yeah. I mean, I got one of the biggies.
Wow. And then you put it all back together. I recall, actually, even in the 80s and 90s, you have done extensive public speaking on near-death experiences, trying to help people understand what this phenomenon is. But what made you decide you were going to devote your life to studying all of this? Or was it a decision? How did that happen?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was a command. And it happened Yes, it happened during my third near-death experience. I believe I was at that place where creation actually occurred, where creation and consciousness actually issued forth. And while I was at that very special place, I heard a voice speak. And it wasn't like you and me voices. It wasn't like angel voices. It wasn't like guides and guardians. I've heard those kinds of voices, etheric voices. No! It was a voice so big and so powerful. We don't have words for that kind of voice. So I
no.
called it the voice like none other. My belief was that was the voice of God, but I don't know for sure. I just know it was the voice like none other, and that voice said, and I quote, "Test revelation. You are to do the research, one book for each death." It did not name book one. It did name book two and three. It told me what was to be in each book, but not how to do the work or how long it would take me to do the work. So when I came back, I was filled with that intensity, that drive, that passion. I've got a job to do. But, you know, I had to, my first job was my body. I had to rebuild that. And then I actually began my work in 1978. I met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at O'Hare Airport. Her plane was late for about an hour going to Europe. And I happened to be there at the same time. Don't you love that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just happened to be there at the same time.
Yeah,
and so I went up to her and met the woman, and the two of us sat down on a little bench and talked like a couple of schoolgirls, and I told her all about my three episodes, and she was the one who gave me the term near-death experience. She validated my experiences, and that was wonderful. She called me a near-death survivor, though. She did not use the word experiencer.
That's the way people thought then. I think that we've evolved in the way we look at that experience.
Well, she never mentioned Raymond Moody. She never mentioned the book Life After Life. I'd never heard of either. And I started my research a couple of months after meeting her. And been intensely doing that work ever since. So my work was not based on the Moody model.
So at this point in the early 80s, I guess, you were probably one of the very few people who were actually doing this research in a serious way, which is why I say I think that you're the, and you kept it up your whole life. I mean, I've seen films of you. I saw one wonderful one on the Zamet newsletter. Here's my plug for the Zamet newsletter. Go to victorzamet.com and just subscribe to this wonderful weekly newsletter they do about near-death experiences and all the other things that are important in this field. It's the best news you'll read all week. And one of the things that they had a few weeks ago, or maybe it was more than a month ago now, was a clip of you, PMH, and you were on Geraldo. And you looked the way you look now. It was, of course, he looked very, very young. And you were speaking in your serious, disciplined, scholarly way. And he was saying garbled nonsense. You know, the same things people say over and over again. Well, it could be, dying brain and this and that nonsense, all of which had by then even been thoroughly discredited. It must have been very frustrating for you to keep talking to people when they still would go back to the same foolishness?
That's your dedication. That's what you're doing. And, yes, I had a lot of things to learn, and it took me years and years to learn them because I didn't know how to handle this. I didn't know how to handle television or radio or anything else, and I learned by doing. And I just stayed with it because I knew this is what I had to do. There was no question in my mind.
Yes, your boss had told you this is your job.
Yeah, this is it. Period.
Oh, wow.
End of story. So
yeah.
I stayed with it. No matter how many times I was attacked, no matter how many times I made a fool of myself, didn't matter. I just stayed the course.
Oh, bless you, dear. That's wonderful. And how did you begin to do this research? You began to investigate people's experiences, to interview them? Was that how this all began?
It all began one particular night when I had received an invitation to speak at this community college. And I went there, and I talked about my own experiences. And there were people in the audience who had also had an experience. So when that talk was over, we all got together in a special room and started talking to each other. And then I realized it was very clear to me what I was to do and how I was to do it. Because I saw the bodies of these people interacting. I saw the energies interacting. I saw the words moving and arcing in the air. And I knew that I had to do observation work, not just listening. Roberta, I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station. And Dad always told me the body says more than the mouth does.
Oh,
so I watched bodies intently.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, this is very important, this beginning to look at near-death experiences seriously. I think for a long time they were ignored, and by mainstream science and by the media, then it became impossible to ignore them, to the point where now you were telling me that they're one of the most important ways we study consciousness. Tell me that story.
Well, today the near-death experience is recognized by scientists throughout the world as the best way to study and research consciousness itself. So the tops in the field all over are now using near-death experiences expressly for that purpose.
Wow, so we've come a long way, baby. That's great.
Yeah, well, it's a very real phenomenon. No way we can toss it. But, Roberta, there's no way you can talk about the near-death experience without also talking about near-death after effects. There's a pattern of physiological and psychological after effects. And it's validates the experience, not the other way around.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely important point. And many people don't understand that. They focus on some of the amazing stories people have to tell when they've recovered from the near-death experience, being out of body. And
well, they're focusing on the light show with a storyline. Is what they're doing.
What an interesting way to put it.
They're
exactly
not looking at
right.
the phenomenon.
So,
and
so
the phenomenon,
Tell us what are the most common and I promise everyone, we're going to get to talk about God. I want to first orient ourselves toward what a near-death experience is and how it works. And then we'll start talking about some of the astonishing things we learn about God and about PMH Atwater's wonderful new book where she talks about that very thing. But first, what are some of the effects of a near-death experience?
First of all, we need to realize here or center our words around the fact that most near-death experiencers are without vital signs, that means all of the vital signs, from 15 to 20 minutes. Now, we know scientifically that awareness can continue after death for about 3 minutes. But these people, on the average, 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's a little, long.
Many of them, revive in the morgue. Maybe 10 hours later, maybe 18 hours later, maybe several days later.
Wow.
So we're looking at something here that's very dynamic.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you're going to look at the after effects, what's very commonly talked about is that they lose their fear of death afterward, they become more loving, more patient, more of a humanitarian, more of a healer. Yes, that's all true, but we're not looking at the physiological changes. There are changes in brain structure, brain chemistry, changes in the nervous system, changes in the digestive system.
Wow,
skin sensitivity.
Wow.
So we're looking at something extremely dynamic here.
Yes, and that's being studied now, from what you say. All of that is being studied scientifically?
I can't say that all of it is. I can say that most of it is.
Huh.
And there's already some science behind this. We know about the brain structure changes. We know about that scientifically. We know that there are changes in the electromagnetic field around us and in us. Most near-death experiencers afterward developed electrical sensitivity. I'm one of them.
What does that mean, electrical sensitivity? What does that mean?
Well, that means that light bulbs pop. That means that tape recorders smoke.
Oh.
That means that if you walk by a TV show.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's a little amazing.
I mean, that means you can't wear watches.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
Well, I have to be very careful. Before I speak anywhere, I always pray first. Always.
Yeah.
If I don't, I could take down the electrical grid. And that has happened to me
surprising.
Many times.
All right. So these major changes happen in people's bodies. We know that they happen in people's minds. As you say, they become much more focused on the fact that they lose their fear of death. They know that life is eternal, which it is, and they become less materialistic, perhaps more oriented toward helping others.
Right.
And these kinds of effects are really quite remarkable. And I should just add, they're consistent with the same effects we find from people who study the afterlife evidence. I'm in touch with more and more people who've been on that journey that I've been on for decades, and they share the same characteristics: not afraid of death, very much oriented toward helping others, not caring about material things, much happier. I think happiness is one of the primary effects, at least, of understanding the afterlife evidence. It's really striking. But you've found that some near-death experiences are negative, which I think is something that many people don't realize. You say about 1 in 7 near-death experiences is a negative experience?
Well, let's be careful about the usage of the words positive, negative, because both of those are judgmental terms. I would say that in my research base, 1 out of 7 had a terrifying or frightening experience.
Okay.
I would not use the term negative, because in many cases, what turns out to be what we label negative turns out to be extremely positive and miraculous. So you have to be very careful how you use those words.
It would shape anyone up, right. I've seen that, too, in the bit of research I've done in this field.
Sure, and sometimes what we call positive turns out to be very negative in the chance.
People.
Yeah, that hurts the person's life and confuses them rather than uplifts them.
What I'm really talking about then is people who have experiences that most of us would consider dark or frightening.
Right.
And there even have been people who have felt they were in a burning hell, and people who have been in quite what we know of as the outer darkness, which is the lowest afterlife level of which we're aware. Really, really scary stuff. Also, some weirdly scary stuff, being in a whirlpool or being sucked into nothingness, things that are not reported at all in the afterlife literature, but a lot of these are experiences we would prefer not to have if it were our choice. But you say people who have these experiences come out of them in a positive way very often. That's reassuring to hear.
Yeah, many of them do. And don't get hung up on heat and fire and a burning hell, because very few were like that. Most of them were cold.
Yes. Well, that's what the afterlife negative area actually is.
It's cold,
not hot. Right.
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 So all of that is sort of prelude. Now, let's talk a little bit about how you came to discover things about the eternal source. What you call God, I call mind, but it's all the same. But apparently you encountered this source right at the start of your voyage.
Well, for me, yes.
Okay.
In dealing with other people, other near-death experiencers as myself, yes, again and again and again and again. And I can say now, with a research base of nearly 4,000 adults and children that 90 to 95% experienced and came to know, positively know, God.
Wow.
Now, not all of them use that term God. They can call it presence. They can call it the one mind. They can call it divinity. They can call it whatever they want to call it. But in essence, this idea of an intelligence that is so great, an intelligent creator. Again, the idea of a creator that is so massive that we can't even begin to identify it or name it.
Yes.
Most near-death experiencers come back still using the term God. In the book I wrote, Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience, I was very careful to use the term God, Allah, deity.
Yes.
In honor of the three major ways we look at that incredible creative intelligence.
Yeah, the book that is about to come out, is called Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience. And I've been able to read just a part of it because I just received it yesterday, but it is really a beautiful book for anyone who is curious to better understand not just the near-death experience, but what this being is that really is the only thing that exists. We, just as fish, ask a fish to describe water, a fish is hardly aware of water because that's the only thing the fish knows. Well, to a great extent, that's almost how we are in the eternal mind, in the God, in the spirit that is really all that exists. And it's glorious to find that there is this whole, I didn't fully appreciate the extent to which near-death experiencers were immersed in eternal mind, in the source, in God, until I read parts of your book really last night. And I think it's exciting that we have this great revelation of what this spirit is. We're going to talk a lot more about it. I just want to remind you, this is Roberta Grimes, and you're listening to Seek Reality. My books are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and The Fun of Staying in Touch, and which is about how we can communicate with the dead and how the dead communicate with us. And we're talking with PMH Atwater, who is the leading researcher in the field of near-death studies. Others may claim the title, but she is it. And the reason I say that is some of the most important people in this field have done wonderful work, but they haven't made it the core of a disciplined research project lifelong, just as PMH has. I mean, Raymond Moody is just the star in this field, but the beauty of Raymond Moody is he's doing something different. He's been researching all kinds of stuff in his life. He's worked on psychomantiums. He's worked on deathbed visions. If you look at what his books are on Amazon, you'll see he's been all over the field. And we have some experiencers who've become quite famous for being experiencers, like most recently perhaps Dr. Eben Alexander, who speaks beautifully about his experiences, which were extraordinary. But again, he's not a researcher. What we need in the field of near-death studies and in the field of afterlife studies is people who are willing to dig in, interview thousands of people, put together all of those experiences, and do science with them. And the only person who's really been doing that, of which I'm aware, since the beginning of this field is Dr. Atwater. So I'm so honored to have you with us, PMH. I think this is so important that you get your word out as much as you can about what the science is behind all of this. And so,
I also want to mention here Dr. Bruce Grayson, because
he's also done a lot of research.
But nobody
there are others.
but nobody has gone as deeply into the after effects as I have.
Yeah, this is a field, I think, which as you say, is going mainstream now. And to hear that scientists are taking it seriously is encouraging, because even through the first part of the 21st century, they were doing what they could to debunk near-death experiences.
Well, they still are. They haven't quit.
So just before we go back to talking about God, which is really the focus of this, I'm so interested in exploring with you for the benefit of people listening, the other areas here. Talk about what some of the things they do to try to debunk near-death experiences.
One of the biggies is neurosurgeons talk about the tunnel, and they say, you know, our vision, our optic nerve shrinks or changes as we die, and it forms a tunnel, and this is what everybody is seeing. Well, my dear, not that many people experience a tunnel.
That's
in 1982, Gallup poll did the first scientific survey on near-death experiences, and only 9% of the people experienced a tunnel.
So you're telling us that 9% of people worldwide...
In 1982, 9% reported a tunnel. To this day, most people do not report tunnels. In most places in the world, they've never heard of tunnels.
Yeah, and I should just add that I had never, in all of reading many hundreds of communications from people who had actually died that were received before 1950, I never found a single description of a tunnel or a light in any. Nobody mentioned it. It doesn't seem to be part of a normal planned death. Ever.
So if a scientist uses that to disprove near-death experiences, they're way out in left field.
Yeah, that's crazy.
They haven't done their research.
That's right. But this is how debunkers work, and I think it's important to just mention, this is when any afterlife-related phenomenon gets the attention of the public, people who think they're defending the faith of atheistic materialist science will try to debunk whatever this thing is that people are paying attention to. And the important thing that they debunk, of course, is near-death experiences, since they're so much in the mainstream now. And what they do is simple. They find some little thing that they can prove has a normal explanation. Therefore, they have proven that the whole thing is normal or is explainable. Now, this is absolute patent garbage, obviously, because the things they choose in any area they debunk simply show their complete ignorance about the field. You can't do science based in ignorance, and yet that's what debunkers do. And these debunkers are all over the internet. You can't, sadly, and I'm sad about this, you can't trust Wikipedia on any topic remotely related to the afterlife, to eternal life, to near-death experiences, to any of this.
That's because Wikipedia is constantly changed. People go in there and change what's listed.
Yes. And if people try to correct the mistakes there, it's actually being policed by a group of people who are basically taking the debunkers at face and ignoring or deleting anything that's put there by people who actually know what they're talking about.
This has become a plague.
Yeah,
it's happening so often.
So. What we have to do is go to websites of people who actually know what they're talking about. And fortunately, there is a project now underway, which is going to basically come up with an online encyclopedia just in these areas, which will give genuine information and in an unbiased way. I mean, there are probably areas where our interpretations are wrong. In fact, I'm sure there are. When we have actual scientists in volume working in these fields, and that day will come, and the people working now will be, if they're still alive at that time, embarrassed and appalled that they've wasted their careers. But there will be real scientists working to discover these truths, and they will come up with better explanations than people who are not scientists. We're stuck now with lawyers and other researchers who are doing the best we can. But only know that these are real fields. And what's fun is This is a whole new real view of reality, which is at least as enormous and all-encompassing as the view of reality that mainstream science now has. I would argue in some ways it's greater, and it certainly completes the reality that mainstream scientists tell us they're studying. And the fun of it for you and me, PMH, and for everyone listening is we can do this research now. We don't have to wait until people who are calling themselves scientists actually begin to do science in this field. It's just exciting to me that you tell me any of them are. And the thing about consciousness is that they've kind of run out of juice in this field, and so they're probably turning to near-death experiences in frustration, because every attempt that's been made to find a source of consciousness in the brain, of course, can't find one. And they never will find one. And because that's the case, they've got to look at whatever they can that is going to help them better understand consciousness. But that's a very encouraging bit of information that they're starting to do science in this field using near-death experiences. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, where we're moving, Roberta, is where Wolfgang Pauli, the famous physicist, decreed. And he said, a new science is needed to explore the objective side to human consciousness and the subjective side of matter, not mysticism, but a science willing
yes.
to incorporate objective and subjective avenues to discovery while recognizing the legitimacy of personal experience.
Perfect.
This is Wolfgang Pauli. And
yeah.
this is what I've dedicated my work to, is Wolfgang Pauli. By the way, he also had electrical sensitivity. He was bringing down labs right and left.
Apparently, a lot of people can do this kind of thing. And it's always has struck me as odd, but I've known people who, if they walked down a street, the street lamps would go out above their heads.
Yeah.
And I think that's
Well, they've had some kind of experience that shifted their their field around them, the electromagnetism around them. And once that field is shifted, then you get all these anomalies. Like yesterday, the electrician came out and fixed the light that was supposed to be shining over my kitchen sink. It seemed to pop out and wouldn't work anymore. And it had been working just fine for decades. All of a sudden, doesn't work. So he takes the thing down, looks at me kind of funny, and he says, you say this has been working and no problem? And I said, yes. Why? And he said, well, it's not wired up. The wires don't connect with anything. You know, there's no way this could have ever worked.
Oh, isn't that amazing? Yeah,
and I just looked at him and smiled and said, well, you know, welcome to my world.
Yeah, wow. I should note, too, that there are a number of very prominent physicists who have understood that there was a lot more going on than the materialist clockwork physics that still is by dogma being enforced in universities. My particular hero is Max Planck, and in my books I include a number of wonderful quotations from him. But what he was the father of quantum physics, acknowledged to be. He received the 1918 Nobel Prize in Physics for being the father of quantum physics. We're talking a big cheese here. And he said in 1931 that consciousness is primary. He said, we cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we believe exists, postulates consciousness. Wow, that's important, and he was ignored for that. That part of his work, I guess they decided he turned flaky as he got older. I have no idea why. They thought his great discovery, and to me this is the greatest discovery in all of human history, that human consciousness is primary and pre-existing. Pre-exists the universe, has to have pre-existed the universe, has to be primary. And you know, sooner or later, scientists will start to do this research, But it seems
well,
at this point,
look real carefully.
They're going to do everything else first.
Look real carefully at what adults are saying. They're saying that, especially adults, are saying that the light they see on the other side of death is so bright, it is brighter than 10,000 suns.
Yes.
We're talking electricity here. They're saying that when it hits you, when you're in it, you're instantly fried, but there's no pain.
Yeah.
Okay, wait a minute. Let's trace that. Let's look at electricity. Children talk about electricity too, and they're talking about the breath of God, that everything on the other side of death breathes, but it doesn't breathe as your nose does. They're talking movement. They're talking electricity. And when the person comes back, they are changed as if indeed they were fried. So we're talking about something that is dynamic here.
It's an energy, absolutely right. When I was 8 and again at the age of 20, I saw spiritual light as a flash. That was the experience that I had. And I can testify it's much brighter than sunlight, but it doesn't hurt your eyes. It's a different kind of light altogether. And I've talked about this before, but I'll mention it again here because it fits so well. In the summer of 2014, scientists discovered, rather belatedly, why they didn't notice this before, I don't know, that 80% of the light in the nearby universe seems to have no source. One scientist said it's like going into a big warehouse without windows, and it's full of light, and you see there are only 2 60-watt bulbs, and where the heck is the rest of that light coming from? Well, PMH, you know, and I know where that light is coming from. That's coming directly from the source.
Right.
It's not a coincidence that 68% of the universe, by scientists' own calculations, is dark energy, dark only because, not because it's bad, but because it will not interact with photons and will not give off photons.
This is what thousands of near-death experiencers say. That light is the very essence, the heart and soul, the all-consuming consummation of ecstatic ecstasy. It is indeed a million suns of compressed love, dissolving everything unto itself, annihilating thought and cell, vaporizing humanness and history into that one great brilliance of all that is, all that ever was, and all that will ever be. You know the light is God. No one has to tell you. You know. You can no longer believe in God afterward. For belief implies doubt. There is no more doubt. You now know God, and you know who you are, a child of God, a cell in the greater body, an extension of the one force, an expression of the one mind. No more can you forget your identity or deny or ignore or pretend it away. There is one, and you are of the one, the light does this to you. It cradles your soul in the heart of its pulse beat, and it fills you with love shine.
Wow, that's beautiful. Well, that's pretty much where I've come from, entirely different, or maybe not so entirely different direction, simply reading what the dead tell us about God. The way I would describe God is, number one, God is the only thing that exists. I don't use the term God for one reason, which is that nothing that we have found, those of us who have looked hard for it, nothing we have found suggests that there is an anthropomorphic deity. That guy with the beard who's you know, thunderbolt.
Yeah, but bear in mind, near-death experiences do not think, most of them, do not think of God anymore as that kind of figure, that
right.
God is
That's
genderless.
Right. God is genderless and God doesn't have a body. God
right.
is, God is not a human construction.
God
All
is not
gods,
a man or a male. God is not a female or a goddess. Uh-uh.
And God has no human failings either.
Right.
God is not human-like at all.
Right.
We, at our highest aspirations, that was a little pun, at our highest aspirations, we are like God because we actually are of God. The evidence
right.
suggests strongly that our minds are part of that source
we
of energy.
We are created in that image.
Yes.
And that image is one of pulse beat.
Yes. In fact, as I said, PMH and I sometimes subtly differ in our expression, but it doesn't really matter. What I've come to believe is that actually our minds are part of that source. That's
yes.
how closely
Absolutely.
We are identified with it.
One mind, many thinkers.
That's right. There's only really one of us here, and that one is God, or mind, or source. And the definition that I've come to follow, and again, this is an ineffable energy. We cannot really understand it in human terms. But I've come to think of God as an energy-like potentiality without size, without form, alive in the same way your mind is alive because your mind is part of that energy, infinitely powerful, highly emotional, therefore probably self-aware, and the only emotion that energy expresses is love beyond our ability to comprehend it. That's what God is to me. And I don't believe, I agree with you, I don't believe in God. I know that's what God is. And I know that God is the only thing that exists. And knowing, frankly, is a heck of a lot better than believing, don't you think?
Absolutely. And that's what we come back. That's how we come back. We come back knowing God. There's no more, this idea of belief has no place. You know
yes,
God.
Yes, I agree with you. Yes. The problem with belief is that it's based in human understandings, other people's understandings of what's really going on, whether we're talking about belief in the afterlife, belief in, you know, the validity of near-death experiences, belief in God. When you let dogmas get in the way, and this is the big mistake science has made, and made actually 100 years ago, when it adopted atheism and materialism as its fundamental dogmas, and you can find that in print, by the way. They used to say that. They don't say it anymore, but it's still true. But that's when they stopped becoming open-minded seekers of the truth. And when we accept dogmas that are rooted in religions or rooted in what other people tell us, we make it impossible for us to come to know God directly. The joy of a near-death experiencer, the joy of someone who has done a lot of afterlife research is we begin to come to know God directly without anybody in the way. And that, to me, that is the greatest
right.
fruit. It isn't just loss of fear. That's great. And then since fear of death is the base fear, you don't fear anything anymore. That's all terrific. It's not that you're happy all the time. Well, that's fun too. And many of us are happy all the time now because how can you be sad when everything is so glorious? But the core joy is, well, George Harrison would have understood it. My sweet Lord, I really want to know you. I really want to go with you. To really come to know God on a personal level is the most joyous experience that any of us can possibly have. Don't you agree?
Right. Right. And that's what these people are echoing. That it's now personal.
Yeah, that's it. It is personal and there's no fear. Fear is the opposite of love. And when you fear God, you cannot love God. And God wants only to be loved. God loves us more than we can possibly imagine. God doesn't judge us. I have never, in all my looking for it, in nearly 200 years of communications from the dead, I've never seen anything which suggests that God ever has judged a single person. God just loves us beyond our ability to imagine it. And that's
well, sometimes the life reviews are pretty heavy. And
yeah.
sometimes there is judgment. But that judgment doesn't come from this great intelligence. That judgment seems to come from what we need to hear and what we
That's
need
right.
to see.
That's right. The afterlife evidence and the communications from people who've completed their their transition and are now living in the afterlife pretty consistently says that they ended up being their own judge. They,
right.
They were shown their lives, and then they were told, now it's time to forgive everybody. And I've never seen a single case where they didn't forgive everybody. And then they were told, okay, now it's time to forgive yourself for what, the things you did in that lifetime. And people who've been through it say it's the hardest thing you ever, ever had to do is to forgive yourself, because you know the things you planned to do. You know how important loving and forgiving were, and you got to see all the times you'd fallen short. And that's tough.
That can be really tough. The life reviews, some life reviews and near-death experiences are very radical. They're very painful.
Yeah.
Again, it's tough stuff. This one experiencer in my research base in Chicago, Illinois, of all places, a fellow, a man, was part of the mafia.
Oh my!
And he was one of the hitmen with the mafia.
Oh my goodness!
He had a near-death experience.
Oh.
And in his near-death experience, he had one of these radical life reviews.
I'll say.
And it was so radical that not only did he see and experience everyone he'd ever hurt, but he had to feel their pain, the pain of their families, their friends, what they went through. So he got their pain, he got their family and significant others' pain as well. And when he came back, he was so traumatized that all he could do was serve meals to people in the basement of a church. And I asked him about that, and he said, I want somehow to pay it back. To just in some way give back, and he was still just traumatized.
Yes, well, that's a very important point about everybody's life review, and everybody listening will be there and will get to see and feel how you made everybody else feel in your entire life, for good or for ill. People who have done wonderful things in their lives for other people get to experience that, the joy of others.
Well, it seems to work that way. I'm very careful when I'm saying words like always and it's guaranteed and this is what you will do, because those are very heavy terms. What I would rather say is that it that the research shows that
this
is what occurs.
I know, but you're such a scientist, CMH. I am a visionary more than a scientist, perhaps.
I back away from absolute terms, dear.
Yes, I have to say that based upon decades of reading afterlife communication.
Yeah, but, you know, I found
exceptions.
Maybe you haven't, but I have.
Well, when people have completed their death and they're there and this is the natural process
of life.
Some of
them, dear, wind up in the borderlands.
Well,
you know, it takes
later,
a while.
It can take a while to get there, that's true. But sooner or later, all of us are going to face judgment. That's what the upper-level beings tell us, and I think that that's probably true, although, as you point out,
sooner or later,
track,
all of us are going to meet ourselves.
That's true. That's really what it is to face judgment.
That's what it's all about.
But just remember, it's only you that will judge. I have never seen any instance of any religious figure judging someone who had died. Instead,
I have.
We have
continuously, especially with children. So I think we need to be very careful here when we're talking about judgment.
Yes. One of the ways in which the study of near-death experiences, and there are a number of them actually, differs from the study of completed deaths is that it doesn't ever seem to happen in a completed death that you have judgment by anyone but yourself. And the upper-level beings tell us that's true. But you're absolutely right. In near-death experiences and in anything short of a completed permanent death, it can be that you will believe that you are being judged by beings that are, you know, angels or guides or perhaps even God. But whatever the judgment is, sooner or later, as you say, PMH, you have to meet yourself. And knowing that, thinking of that poor man spending the rest of his life serving meals in the basement of a church, think in terms of living the kind of life that when it's time for you really to meet yourself, you're going to really like
then
the
you begin to lift.
Meeting.
Then you begin to lift.
Yes. This is what we learn from all these different disciplines. What we learn is that it's very, very important to prepare yourself to meet yourself, to prepare yourself to have grown enough in this lifetime that you'll feel good about your lifetime, because that's why we're here. We're here to grow spiritually. I am
Absolutely.
So sorry that we're coming to the end of our time, and I'm having so much fun chatting with you. We're going to have to do this again. PMH
and don't
Atwater,
forget, the book is Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience.
I was just going to say that. This book is wonderful, Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience. What people who are experiencers have found, and PMH says it's 90% plus, they've discovered God and it has transformed their lives. And
yeah.
And that, to me, is a truly beautiful reason to further study near-death experiences. If you've read no other books on the topic, or if you've read many of them, read Dying to Know You. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. This has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, and you never will end. And when you fully understand what that really means, you will be totally and happily transformed forever. If you'd like to learn more about some of the amazing things we're coming to understand about our one reality, past episodes of Seek Reality are available for free on iTunes. Just search there for Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. And I've said also that my own nonfiction books on this topic are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, which covers the same area, only looking exclusively at completed deaths. And we're coming to understand all the weird ways in which near-death experiences and completed deaths differ, but the much more important ways in which they're really the same thing. And also, I wrote The Fun of Staying in Touch just out this fall, which explores all the ways our dead loved ones give us signs of their survival and some of the beautiful ways we're learning to communicate better with them. You can learn more about all my books. You can read previews of them. And you can also read my blog, which I'd love to have you do, at robertagrimes.com. Also, if you want to contact me, you can always contact me through robertagrimes.com. I do answer my emails. I tell people, if you don't hear from me in 24 hours, send flowers. My guest next week will be Waller Dole. He's another afterlife communications researcher, and he also has done considerable work in the field of physical mediumship. We've just heard Donna Smith Moncrief, who is a really eminent researcher in this field, and Waller Dole is another person who's done a lot of research. I think physical mediumship is an important place for us to begin to understand just what is possible in terms of further really coming to grasp what's going on. My guest today has been PMH Atwater. Dr. Atwater's work is more proof that standard research techniques can be used to study all the afterlife fields, including the wonderful, amazing field of near-death experiences. And she helps us prove that the most important thing of all about this may be that these techniques, standard research techniques, can be used for us to study and begin to understand God. God, if you want a better relationship with God, then studying the afterlife would be a great beginning for you. For now, please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our one reality, knowing that you are a powerful, eternal being and you are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.